Alias, Wendy Wallace. 6 years ago. I love this little town. In another life, I would have graduated from high school and headed straight here for college. I would have gone to every sporting event and play and art showing. Breaks between classes would have been spent in the quad, where I'd complain with fellow students on the unfairness of how our professor graded our last exam. But I'm not living that life. I was only in that airport hotel in Raleigh for a day before there was a knock on the door. I opened it to find a guy in a UPS uniform standing on the other side. But upon closer inspection, I realized it was the same guy who delivered my last set of instructions from Matt. "You're George," I said. He looked confused.
"I'm sorry, who?"
he asked. I pointed to the space on my tee where a name tag would be if I had one. "George. It was the name on your uniform at the hotel in Hilton Head." He seemed surprised I would remember that. "But I'm guessing that's not your real name." He handed me a plain brown package without any address or shipping label and said,
"No, it's not."
I'm sure he's not supposed to be talking to me, just delivering things. "Are you going to tell me your real name, or do I just keep calling you George?" He shrugged.
"George works, I guess."
"Okay, George it is." He started to step away, but he stopped when I asked, "You coming to Florida with me, or do you have other deliveries to make?" Another shrug.
"You'll have to wait and see."
And then he was gone. Ripping the package open, I found a Florida driver's license in the name of Wendy Wallace, along with a slip of paper listing the address of a shipping and container store, including the mailbox number and the name of an apartment complex and unit number. There were also two keys on a keychain, one key much bigger than the other. And lastly, there was a picture of a man in his mid to late 30s. On the back of the picture was his name, Mitch Cameron, and "Get to know everything about him," written underneath it. I found Mitch Cameron immediately. Everyone knows Mitch Cameron, since he's the head football coach for a college in Central Florida. He is loved and hated in equal parts. Mitch is 37 years old and has been married to Mindy for the last 10 years. Mitch and Mindy, how adorable. Mitch is also the father of two young kids, a boy named Mitch Jr. and a girl named Matilda. This family is brought to you by the letter M. It only took 4 days for me to learn everything about Mitch and what his daily life looked like, although I couldn't for the life of me figure out why a college football coach was the mark. I'm never told who the client is, but I'm anxious to find out what's going on with Mitch that necessitated hiring Mr. Smith. Every day this week, I've ridden my bike to the practice field so I can watch him at work. Today, I've spread a blanket out, surrounded myself with textbooks, just like the half dozen other students studying outside on a fall afternoon, the Florida sun turning my skin a gorgeous tan. I've never spent so much time outdoors. Mitch seems well-liked by his players. He's tough on them, but he's also encouraging and not afraid to tell them when they've worked hard. Just like every day, when practice ends and Mitch sends the players to the showers, I pack up and head to the package center to check the mailbox. It's been empty every time I've checked so far, but today I'm feeling lucky. A little shriek of excitement slips out when I see the small envelope inside. Finally! I slide it in the waistband of my shorts and pull my shirt over it, leaving the store as quickly as possible. I don't open it until I've reached the safety of my apartment. There is a single piece of paper inside that lists 5 names with a date and time next to each one. I only need to Google 2 names before I see a pattern. Every person on this list is a high school senior who lives within a 60-mile radius of the university and has had an amazing football career so far. And there is speculation about where all of them will end up playing next fall. At first, this seems ridiculous to me. Why am I here? To monitor some football coach and a handful of 18-year-old boys? I deep dive into high school and college football. I realize the millions and millions of dollars that universities make on the backs of these players before they go pro, if they're lucky enough to go pro. It is a big business. There's also a lot of talk about players getting paid under the table to pick one college over another. Stories of bagmen dropping off cash late at night and communicating by burner phone, And even more mind-blowing are the college boosters, aka old people, who spend big money in the hopes that their alma mater might possibly win a championship. They throw cash at programs and expect results. And if they don't get them, the money stops. There's a real question as to who is actually running these programs, the school's athletic director or the wealthy few writing the checks. All you need to do is Google T. Boone Pickens and Oklahoma State University to get the general idea. There is a big push to change the rules and allow college athletes to profit off their name and likeness. In fact, most people in the industry believe the NCAA will allow student athletes to accept endorsements as early as 2020 or 2021. But for now, it is strictly forbidden. If caught paying players, schools are fined huge sums and could even lose opportunities to go to bowl games at the end of their season, which kills their recruiting efforts. But the worst penalty is to the athlete. They lose their eligibility to play anywhere. The last few jobs, I've used this time in the lull between getting information but still waiting for exact instructions to guess what the client has hired us to do. Since the prospective players' names were given to me, I'm guessing they play into this somehow. Is Mitch a dirty recruiter? Is the client a rival school who wants Mitch's program in trouble? I concentrate on the dates and names. I map out where each player lives. I learn their stats. I scour their social media. Five names. Five dates. The first takes place in 1 week. I'm going to need some tech and help installing it. So I follow the steps Devin has set up and ask him to come to Florida. I plan to watch Mitch Cameron court these players, but I didn't anticipate I would also catch coaches from other schools visiting them too. These guys are the best of the best from this area, and everyone wants them. While the university Mitch coaches for is a good one, there are a couple of bigger and better ones not far from here. So the competition is strong. It was easier than I thought it would be for us to get in each player's home to set up once Devin arrived with the equipment we needed. All their houses are in poor neighborhoods with little to no security in place. It's hard to ignore how much money is at stake for colleges with a winning season. Yet these boys aren't even supposed to get their dinner paid for by anyone associated with the school. It doesn't seem fair. A week into spying on these guys, there's another note in the mailbox. All recordings, videos, and images of the subjects from the previous list that document meetings, conversations, or discussions, even discussions between family members, regarding any football program, should be turned in. A courier will arrive at your apartment every night at 10 p.m. for pickup. Do not leave it in the mailbox. I knew Mr. Smith would be keeping a close eye on me, but I didn't realize just how close. It also weighs heavy in favor of the client being from a rival school. Mr. Smith doesn't want the conversations just between the players and Mitch, but they're conversations with all the coaches. But the coaches aren't the only ones showing up to talk to these guys. It's quickly obvious who the most valued player is. Tyron Nichols. Tyron lives in one of the poorest black communities in the same town as the university. His house consists of three small bedrooms and one tiny bathroom. But is home to Tyron, his parents, a grandmother, and five younger siblings. His parents work long hours, while the grandmother tends to the kids who aren't in school yet. It's clear his parents have no idea what to do with all the attention Tyron is getting. But Tyron is smart. Even though he's been offered money, he hasn't taken any of it. Because when it comes down to it, Tyron is the one with the most at stake. If he loses his eligibility, he doesn't play. There's a close to zero chance he'll go to the NFL, where he'd finally get paid what he's worth, if he doesn't have a successful college football career first. I watch on my small screen when men in starched button-down shirts show up at Tyron's door. I notice how he handles himself with them, and then later listen in on the conversations he has with his brother, who is only 1 year younger, about what's being offered. By the second week, I'm exhausted. Even though Devin and I are dividing and conquering, it takes us all day to skim through footage from all five locations and separate the relevant parts before George knocks on my door in his UPS uniform. The only good thing is that George seems to be warming up to me. The first pickup or two, it was all business. But now he lingers in my doorway and chats a bit. I even gave him a few slices of pizza last night for the road, since he looked as worn out as we did. Makes me wonder how much area he's covering in a day if he's got to be back here every night. While we've gotten some dirt on some of the other coaches, Mitch Cameron hasn't stepped out of bounds once in any of his meetings with potential players. He's upfront about his desire for them to be a part of his team. He's courteous to the family, complimentary about whatever food or drink is put in front of him. He is the perfect guest. I'm having flashbacks to my time with Andrew Marshall, and there's a tight twist in my gut about what I might be asked to do. I'm ready to know what the job is. After another long day of scrolling through videos, I drop the thumb drive in an envelope and glance at the clock. George should be here any second. Once Devin saw the last set of instructions, he wouldn't come to this apartment at all, since he doesn't like the idea of George being so close by. So I've had to add in a trip to get what he's recorded. Those meeting spots change daily. Two quick taps on the door lets me know he's here. "Hey, George," I say, handing him the small package. His forehead crinkles.
"You're not looking so good."
"Always the charmer," I roll my eyes. "You watch surveillance videos all day long and let me see what you look like." He hands me a manila envelope.
"Got something for you tonight. Thought I'd save you a trip to the mailbox since I have to come by here anyway. Just don't rat me out."
My relief is evident. Finally. And don't worry, your secret is safe with me. I'm ready to tear into it, but I notice George is lingering in the hall. "Is there something else?" He nods once, then says in a near whisper,
"Since this is your first job where you're dealing directly with him, if it feels like a test, it is."
I stare at him with wide eyes, silently begging for him to tell me more. But with those cryptic words, he's gone. I can't rip open the envelope fast enough. Cameron needs to be removed from his position without negative outcome financially or publicly to him, the university, or the program, or any future prospects. No scandal. I had a lot of theories of what I'd be asked to do, but this didn't make the top 10. And while the desired outcome and parameters are very clear, these instructions still feel very vague.
"If it feels like a test, it is." Well, here we go.
It took a few days for me to walk through my options and weigh the potential for success against the risks of breaking one of the rules Mr. Smith laid down. I can't load some underage porn on Mitch's computer and blackmail him into quitting, because for one, there's no guarantee that it won't turn into some scandal. And two, if he quits, he forfeits the rest of what's left in his contract, $6 million. And that would hurt him financially. Blackmail on his wife leads to the same results, and blackmail on any member of the college opens them up to scandal and also hurts them financially, since they'd have to buy out his contract. I feel like I'm boxed in. I feel like I'm going to fail his test. The only thing to do is start back at the beginning. He wouldn't set me up to completely fail, so I'm missing something. He wants me to prove myself, so there is a way to get this job done. I just need to find it. The Ford dealership is shiny and new. The main room is a big open space with lots of glass and chrome. Salesmen circle the front doors like sharks, but I push my way through without breaking my stride or making eye contact with a single one of them. There's a young blonde at the welcome desk who eyes me up and down quickly, then pastes a gigantic smile on her face.
"Welcome to Southern Ford. How can I help you?"
I need to speak with Phil Robinson.
"I'm not sure he's available."
"Give him this." I drop a white envelope on the counter in front of her. Phil owns 5 Ford dealerships that are scattered throughout Central Florida, but he keeps his main office in this location. It only takes a moment for the receptionist to return and lead me to him. Phil meets us at the door. His eyes track me from the tips of my shoes to the top of my head. I'm feeding him the details I want him to have, to remember. My clothes are nice, but not too nice. My jacket looks like it was fitted especially for me, but it's obvious my skirt is off the rack. My jewelry is minimal but tasteful. My hair is pulled back, and the makeup heavier than what I normally wear. I'm 30, easily. My hand is out as I approach him, and he hesitates a second or two before caving. Mr. Robinson, thank you for seeing me, I say as we shake hands. He motions me inside his office and I do a quick survey of the room. He's a super fan and one of the college's biggest boosters. There are framed jerseys and game balls, pictures with players and coaches, including Mitch Cameron. Phil sinks into his chair behind his desk while gesturing me to take the one across from him.
What's the meaning of this? He asks.
He's opened the envelope and pulled out the picture of stacks of cash sitting on the tailgate of a Ford truck with a sticker of his dealership's logo on the back window. There is no room for small talk. I'm here about Roger McBain. Phil's face shows confusion, but there's red creeping up under his starched white collar.
I don't know anyone named Roger McBain.
My forehead crinkles as if I'm really taking him for his word, and I'm somewhat confused. Then I pull out more pictures. Pictures that show Phil and Roger together. Huh, you two look pretty chummy here. Then I put my iPad on the desk so it faces him. I press play on the video that is waiting on the screen. It's a recording of a dinner with Phil, Roger, and a handful of other mega donors. Their discussion comes to life where they detail which high school prospects they want Roger to approach and how much money they will offer to each one. Phil even offers to throw in a couple of cars if necessary.
Anything to keep them from going to Florida State, he says.
There is also some bragging about how successful they were last year in scoring some of the best recruits. I end the video right after Phil says,
giving away that F-250 was worth those 12 touchdowns.
Phil stares at the screen from across the desk, and I can see the color drain from his face. The one group that was not mentioned on that sheet of paper from Mr. Smith were the boosters. The mark, protected. The school, protected. The program, protected. The prospects, protected. But not a word about those wealthy, overly invested boosters. Mr. Smith knew I'd not only see the players talking to the coaches, but I'd also catch men like Roger McBain approaching them on behalf of boosters like Phil Robinson. Roger works for you. You tell him the players you want to commit to your alma mater, give him the funds to entice them to do so. I came with receipts, and he knows it. He's quiet, toying with a black ballpoint pen in his hands. I have just as many pics of you with the athletic director, the university president, and half the coaching staff, so it's not a stretch to assume the school knew what you were doing, and even condoned it. Think the NCAA will give them a 3 or 4 season bowl ban. This is my only bluff, because I can't really pull the school into this, but Phil doesn't know that. I just need him scared enough that I can tie the school to his activities. The last thing he wants is to be the guy who brought down the whole program. He finally speaks.
What is it that you want?
Even though I knew there was zero chance Phil would let the team suffer for something he did, I am relieved he's crumbling under my threat. We want Mitch Cameron gone. You and your little friends will insist he be let go, but you'll be nice about it. You're to say you don't agree with Mitch's vision. You'll say it's time for a rebuild. And then you'll buy out his contract. No reason for the school to eat that $6 million when it's all your fault. His lips peel up over his teeth like he wants to growl at me.
You are under the impression I have more power than I do.
Nope. I believe in you, Phil, I say brightly. I believe you can get it done.
Why?
He asks.
Why, Cameron?
Just like you, we want what's best for the school. We're all on the same team, Phil. He doesn't like my answer, and he doesn't ask anything else. I gather my things, taking my time getting everything back in my bag. I'll expect an official announcement no later than Monday morning. And then I'm gone. 3 days later, I'm back in my apartment, one eye on ESPN and one eye on the continuing footage coming in from the prospects' homes. There haven't been any more notes in the mailbox, and no more nightly pickups from George. I'm in the waiting game to see if my gamble paid off. It's not unheard of for boosters to want a coach gone and to raise the money to buy them out. But that's usually at the end of a losing season, when the coach is doing a poor job. The breaking news on ESPN takes my attention away from the grainy footage of one of the players' houses as I focus on the words flashing across the bottom of the screen. Coach Mitch Cameron is out in Florida. And then the details. The university had terminated their contract with him, and money raised by the boosters will cover his buyout. The reason given was that Coach Cameron and the athletic director had a different vision for the future of the program. That's it. Not even a minute later, there is a knock on the door, and I almost jump out of my skin. Smoothing my hair back, I take a few deep breaths before I open it. And there's the familiar face in the brown UPS uniform, a package in his outstretched hand. Hey, George. I take the package and say, looks like I passed.
Looks like you did.
He smiles and leans against the door jamb.
How does it feel?
Feels pretty good, I answer. He lingers a few more seconds, then pushes away.
See you soon.
And then he's gone. I tear open the package the minute the door closes. Inside is a single typed page, a receipt, and a flip phone. The paper reads, the balance of your fee has been deposited, details included. Keep the phone charged, and you will be contacted for your next job. That's it. I check the deposit receipt and read the note again. I eye the figure on the receipt once more. That's a lot of money, and it's mine. It takes only a few minutes to pack up what I need from the apartment, but I'm not going back to North Carolina. I need to find a spot where I can't be found, a safe place to land between jobs. I've paid attention over the years and know how important it is to save for that inevitable rainy day. Maybe I can tuck away in another small college town like this, one where I can get lost in the sea of students. I picture it, visualize myself in a sleepy little town like this, a cute little house on a quiet street, somewhere safe. Now I just need to see it done. There's one thing I need to do before I go. My new-to-me Honda rolls to a stop in front of the small house, and I lock the door before I make the short walk across the tiny yard. Tyron answers the door a few minutes after I knock. Hey, can you step out here for a second? He's clearly confused, but does what I ask. I walk back to my car and lean against the trunk while he stands on the curb next to me. This is more privacy than we would get inside his house. You don't know me, but I wanted to give you some advice. You have a very bright future ahead of you, and you're smart, but you need to be smarter. Assume someone is listening at all times. Assume someone will rat you out. I know you like to talk to your younger brother about all the offers and extra incentives, but you need to stop. Keep your own counsel. His eyes are big, like freaking out big. And get what you can. Take it all. Make no promises and sign with the team you want, regardless of what any other team offers you. But be smart about that, too. I talk for a few more minutes, and he seems to absorb everything I tell him. He asks questions, and I answer what I can. I give him tips on where to put the money so it grows, how to keep a low profile, how to never trust technology. Just as I'm about to leave, he asks, who are you? I give him a smile and say, someone who has had to grow up fast, just like you. I'm just about to turn and leave, but ask one last thing. Have you ever thought about where you want to play? He shrugs.
Not sure yet. Probably going wherever Coach Cameron ends up.
I nod. Yeah, I hear he's looking for a new school now.
Yeah, he said that was coming, but not to worry.
Something about the way he says it makes me straighten. When did he tell you that? I've watched every interaction between Tyron and Mitch in that house, and I never heard him say that.
I ran into him about a week ago. He was kind of cryptic and shit, but I got what he was saying. He wanted me to know he wanted me even if he wasn't in Florida.
Ran into him? A week ago? Mitch Cameron was let go this morning. He shouldn't have known what was coming a week ago. Very interesting. Chapter 19. Present day. It's late afternoon when we pull into Oxford, Mississippi. Oxford is a picturesque little college town that makes anything seem possible. I direct Ryan to a hotel right off the square that is a favorite with the college students. They study in the lobby during the day, then take a short elevator ride to the roof for cocktails once the sun sets.
"Of all the places I thought you'd take me, this wasn't one of them," Ryan says as we pull into the parking lot.
This college town is home to Ole Miss, one of his alma mater's rivals. "Ever been here?" I ask, mainly just to keep him distracted. It was a long, quiet ride, and I don't really want to get into why we're here.
"Yeah, we came once when LSU played here."
He throws the car in park and turns to me.
"Are we staying here for the night?"
I shake my head. "No, I need you to go up to the rooftop bar, eat something, get a beer, pay in cash. I'll meet you back at the car in 1 hour." I open the car and hop out. He's right behind me.
"We should stick together," he says.
There is a group of girls weighed down by backpacks and purses with Greek letters stretched across their shirts, giving us curious glances. I wait for them to pass, then close the distance between us, putting both my hands on his chest. "We talked about this. The fact that you're here in this town with me while I'm dealing with what I am is huge. I know you think I'm shutting you out, but you are the only person I've let in for years. But I need this hour. Don't make me get it another way." We stare at each other for a minute longer. Then he pulls me closer, kissing me on my forehead.
"1 hour," he says. "You need the keys?"
If Mr. Smith is tracking my car, which is possible, I want him to know we're in Oxford, but I don't want him to have the exact location of where I am right now. Not yet, at least. "No, I'm not going far and would love to stretch my legs." Ryan moves toward the hotel, and I start walking in the opposite direction. I turn down a quiet little street, not far from the square, and stop in front of a beautiful white house with a wraparound porch. Pink blooms explode from the hydrangea bushes in front of the house, and the hummingbirds flutter around feeders hanging from the limb of the huge oak tree. Overflowing pots of spring flowers perch on each brick step. There is a small seating area on the left side of the porch, and an old-fashioned swing hanging on the right side. I stand in front of the door, looking right, then left, then wander to the seating area, where there's a small couch and a rocking chair, both pieces covered in the signature red and blue colors of the university and the words "Hotty Toddy" printed across the throw pillows. I fluff a few of the pillows, dusting off a thin layer of pollen that settles on every single surface this time of the year, spending a little extra time getting the cushions on the rocker just where I want them. This is the home of my dreams, the safe haven I always wanted. Too bad it's not mine. I shove down the wave of longing and move back to the door. A few minutes after ringing the doorbell, a blonde teenager opens it. "Hey," I say, "is your dad home?"
"Sure, let me get him,"
she says, then closes the screen door in my face. I hear her yell for him, and then his heavy steps coming from somewhere deep in the house. The screen door opens slowly, and Mitch Cameron asks,
"Can I help you?"
I knew it was risky coming to his home, but this time of year and this time of day, there's nowhere else he would be, and nowhere else I wanted to meet with him.
"Can I have a minute of your time? My name is Wendy Wallace, and I was the one who helped you get out of your coaching job in Florida," I say.
He steps back as if I've physically assaulted him.
A glance over his shoulder tells him we are alone, but he doesn't want his family to see me, so he steps out onto the front porch, the door closing behind him.
I never expected to be invited inside.
"I'm sorry. I'm not sure what you're referring to."
I move to the seating area, sit in the middle of a small couch, while he watches me, trying to figure out my game. We stare at each other for a tense few seconds, then he eases into the rocking chair next to me.
"I'm really at a loss as to why you're here, miss."
"Call me Wendy. And I'm sure you are." I let the awkwardness settle over us. I invited in to be the third member of this conversation. I let it unravel Mitch like nothing else could. He throws his hands up, and his voice goes a higher pitch than is normal.
"Look, I'm not sure why you're here or what you want, but I was fired, and I was blindsided by it, so maybe you've got the wrong idea about something.
I leaned forward and dropped my voice to a whisper. I'm going to cut through the bullshit and get right to it. You hired my boss to get you out of your contract. You hated the athletic director, and those boosters were a pain in your ass. And after meeting some of them, I can see why. Leaving on your own meant walking away from a shit ton of money, so you hired someone to get you out of it. But you're an honorable enough guy that you didn't want to wreck the program in the process, which means you've got some sense of decency in there somewhere. Mitch has leaned back in his rocker, his elbows resting on the arms of the chair. He looks afraid to move. Since asking what I need or want makes you think you're admitting to something, I'll save you the trouble. I need some money. I came in and did my job. You walked away with a big paycheck and quickly got a new job offer. A job offer I'm assuming you knew was coming. I think it's only fair you help me out now since I helped you out then. His jaw ticks, and his eyes roam from the top of my head down my body. Worried I'm wearing a wire? I stand up and throw my arms out to the side. Feel free to frisk me. He is not amused. But before he says anything else, his phone beeps. Pulling it from his pocket, he looks at the screen a second before tapping against it. A few seconds later, he's finished and shoving the device back in his pocket. I sit again, since it doesn't seem he's going to take me up on my offer to see if I'm wired. We watch each other while he rocks slowly back and forth. It's almost like I can see his mind spinning.
Who are you, really?
He finally asks. I'm no one. I answer. Mitch Cameron is living up to his reputation of a coach with nerves of steel.
Well, no one. You've made a mistake. I loved my job in Florida and would have stayed until retirement if they would have let me. I was fortunate enough to land on my feet here, and now this is home. And I protect my home. It's best that you leave. Now.
I deflate on the couch, and his lips tuck in, stopping him from saying anything else. I can see the pity in his eyes when he stares at me. Getting up from the small couch, I move toward the porch steps. He remains in the rocker. Just as I'm about to step off the porch, I turn back to him and let my frustration bubble to the surface. All of the anger and fury of my boss turning on me after 8 years, and I let it explode out of me. You know what? You're an asshole. I did you a huge favor, and now I need some help, and you know what? You're a fucking dick. Fuck you, and fuck all the way off, you fucker. His face turns red, and he stands up so quickly the rocker almost turns over. I'm focused on his chair, but thankfully it rights itself at the last minute. It would not be good if everything fell out of his chair right now. Mitch spits when he shouts at me.
You have 30 seconds to get off my property, or I'm calling the cops. No one comes to my house and talks to me like that, little girl.
He's not worried about drawing attention now. I need to make sure he's good and pissed, so I throw him the middle finger before stomping down his front walk. That does the trick. He moves away from the rocker and stops on the top step, his hands balled in fists. I'm on the sidewalk in front of his neighbor's house when he finally looks around to see if anyone heard us. I scream, "Screw you, Mitch!" for good measure, then jog down the block. My temper is back in check by the time I'm a couple of streets away. That was out of control, reckless. I let myself go in a way I've never done before. And it felt really good. I check my watch. Ryan should be back in the parking lot of the hotel waiting for me. I don't spare another glance behind me. By the time I get to my car, Ryan is sitting in the driver's seat with the car running. I jump into the passenger seat and say, "Go." I'm trying hard to hide the smile that has stretched across my face. His hand rests on the gear shift, his face turned toward me. His mouth quirks when he says,
"That smile says you've been up to no good. Need me to peel out of here like a good getaway driver, or do you want to give me a general direction to go?"
"Leave Oxford and head north toward Tennessee." He's teasing me, and I'm sort of falling for it.
"I got you some food," he says,
nodding to the back seat. Reaching behind me, my hand closes on the white plastic to-go bag. Inside is a cheeseburger with everything except onions and an order of sweet potato fries. "Thank you," I whisper. We pull away while I grab the burger, taking a huge bite. He's quiet while I eat, and I'm finding it hard to swallow past the lump in my throat. It's the food that got me, and and that he knew I liked sweet potato fries more than regular ones, and that I hate onions unless they're cooked. The thoughtfulness of it has been so rare in my world. I eat quickly, then push all the trash back in the bag it came in when I'm done.
So, just Tennessee?
He asks. I nod. Yes. His jaw flexes, and he seems to struggle with holding back what he wants to say. Finally, he just spits it out.
You made a point to mention how important my appointments on Thursday are. I have a business in Glenview, Texas. It's different work than what I do in Lake Forbing. I acquire things in a questionable way, then sell those things for a significant markup. It's not something that is public knowledge at home, and I plan on keeping it that way.
I'm floored by his admission. But you're telling me, I say. He glances at me, studies my face, then turns his attention back to the road.
Figured I'd go first.
Neither of us say anything else. We ride this way for miles, him staring ahead at the road, me watching the blurred scenery from the side window. I'll tell you everything, but not right now. I have to get past Friday. It comes out as a whisper, but I know he heard every word. Because after Friday, I will know everything I need to know.
I can live with that,
he says.
But come Friday, we're putting it all on the table.
My phone dings, saving me from having to say anything back to him. And a wave of relief courses through me when I see the notification. Ryan glances my way and notices the change.
Good news?
Nodding, I say, yes, just what I needed. I open my phone and pull up the app that allows me to see an exact replica of what's happening on Mitch's phone right now. And sure enough, he did exactly what I hoped he would do. He reached out to Mr. Smith to complain about me. It was a risky move visiting Mitch. I didn't think he would invite me inside, but you never know when you're dealing with deep-seated Southern manners. But luckily, he wanted to ensure there was distance between me and his family, and we kept the porch. And when he sat in the rocker, right on top of the device I planted there just moments before, it was only a matter of him opening the message Devin sent to his phone while I was sitting across from him, and we were in. Given that he is just now getting in touch with my former boss, tells me he thought about it for a bit, which speaks for that level head of his. I'm sure he worried about the risk of making contact again, but my showing up on his doorstep was far more threatening, which is why I had to make a scene before leaving. I could see he felt bad for me at first, and that wasn't going to cut it. I needed him pissed, and a little bit scared of me, enough to take the risk of reaching out. There are a lot of things we don't know about Mr. Smith. Despite Devin's impressive skills, he has been unable to discover his real name or where he lives. The other thing we have been unable to uncover is how clients contact him and how they communicate. After dealing with Devin all these years, I know it's not something as simple as a fake email address. So this is where Mitch comes in. Of all the jobs I've done, this was the only one where I felt certain who the client was, based on that slip from Tyron Nichols. Mitch Cameron knew he was being fired in Florida a week before I approached that mega booster. And he knew to speak to Tyron away from the listening devices in his house when he told him he'd want him on his team, no matter what school he was coaching. Only one way he would have known those things. Mitch Cameron was the client. Now he is deep in a message board created to celebrate the love of a 70s band named King Harvest. I'm guessing most of these messages are meant for my boss, while a few just really love the one hit this band had, Dancing in the Moonlight. The new message window pops up, and Mitch starts typing. Gridiron Boss, I just heard Dancing in the Moonlight for the first time today. That's it. This must be how they make initial contact with Mr. Smith.
Decision time, Ryan says.
He nods at the upcoming signs.
Straight to Memphis or somewhere else?
Not Memphis. Head northeast, I say. And he flicks the turn signal on. We're going to Nashville. He glances my way.
Not Atlanta?
Not yet. He nods.
I'm going to pull over for gas since that's a pretty good stretch. Get some more snacks.
At the next exit, Ryan fills up the tank, then heads into the store. I'm glued to my phone, waiting for a reply to come through to Mitch. And while Mr. Smith may be hesitant to answer Mitch's message, I'm hoping the overwhelming curiosity about what Mitch wants, added to the high probability that he is tracking me and knows we were in Oxford, will get the better of him. I need him to react the way I expect, or I'm dead in the water. Now that I know where to look, I open my browser and find the message board so I can snoop around instead of just seeing what Mitch is looking at. Since Devin can also see Mitch's screen, I'm sure he's doing the same. There are a lot of posts that say, "I just heard Dancing in the Moonlight for the first time today." I always knew I wasn't the only one working for my boss. But by the sheer number of posts, he's got a lot more going on than I originally thought. There are a few usernames that could possibly match up to jobs I've done in the past, but I can only see their initial post. I'm sure the conversations with Mr. Smith are moved to private messages. It's only another minute or so before I get a notification that Mitch has a response to his message. King Harvest Mega Fan. What can I help you with? Gridiron Boss. A girl showed up at my house. Said she worked for you. Wendy something. Asked me for money. She was out of control. Told me to fuck myself when I told her to leave. Screamed it loud enough for the neighbors to hear. I paid you too much money for some crackpot to knock on my door. King Harvest Mega Fan. My apologies for the unexpected visit. I assure you she will be taken care of, and you will not be bothered again. There you are, I whisper. Got you. It's late when we get to Nashville. Ryan pulls up in front of a rundown motel on the edge of town. My door is open before he puts it in park. Wait here. I'll get us a room, I say, 1 foot already out of the door. He cuts the ignition.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. Wait here. He's been frustrated with me since we left Oxford because I have dodged every question he has asked. A few minutes later, I'm back in the car and give Ryan the room number. We park right in front of the door since I asked for a unit on the ground floor. While we could afford nicer accommodations, I prefer to be able to make a quick exit if the need arises. We packed light so it doesn't take long to get settled in.
I'm hitting the shower, Ryan says. I'll find us some food after I get out.
As soon as I hear the water turn on, I pull out my phone and scroll Instagram until I find a comment giving me the meeting time for tomorrow. I comment on a different post, letting Devin know I received his message. When the bathroom door opens, Ryan exits in nothing but a towel. I could look at him all day. His body is exactly my type, fit and trim, but not overly muscular. Ryan must see the glint in my eye, because instead of moving toward his bag, he crawls across the bed toward me. His mood has greatly improved. And I give myself this moment. I push away the plans rolling around in my head, hit pause on my timetable, relish these few stolen moments where we can be normal. I pull him close, and his weight settles over me. My hands drift up to his hair, still damp from the shower.
It's been a hell of a week, he says,
his lips only inches from mine. And it's only Tuesday, I answer. Then my expression turns serious. Regretting coming on this road trip?
Not yet,
he says with a laugh. Ryan kisses that spot on my neck that he knows I love, and I feel it down to my toes. What if I did it? What if I had something to do with Amy Holder's death? My whispered words hang in the air between us. This is self-sabotage at its finest. He stills. Then he lifts his head, and his eyes meet mine.
That's not a question I need the answer to.
Ryan leans closer, his lips landing softly on mine. It's not long before we're skin to skin, and I lose myself in this moment as his hands and mouth roam slowly down my body before working their way back up. His hands grip me tighter. He holds me closer, as if he's afraid I'll disappear. Then he buries his face into that sensitive spot where my neck meets my shoulder. Whispered words flow out of him. Broken sentences that shouldn't make sense, but do. I soak up every word as my nails dig into his back. Show him I feel the same way, without having to say it. Alias, Helen White. 4 years ago. For this job, I'm Helen White, and I'm the farthest west I've ever been. Fort Worth, Texas. I've always wondered why every job I'm given is located in the South. But I guess Mr. Smith must have others who work for him in other parts of the country, so the South must be my territory. It feels very corporate. But Texas is new for me. Everything just feels different here. Bigger and louder, for sure. But there's something else to it. It's almost culture shock. On the surface, the Fort Worth job is supposed to be a simple retrieval. Some painting worth millions was stolen years ago and is believed to be hidden inside the sprawling home of oil tycoon Ralph Tate. Whoever hired us for this job has apparently tried to buy it from Ralph for years, but Ralph won't sell, so we're going to steal it from him instead. But I'm not the only one trying. Mr. Smith loves his games, and this job is the prime example of how twisted he can be. He told me I'm not the only one he's sending after it, but he didn't say exactly how many of us are throwing their hat in the ring. Because this is a contest, and the one who gets the painting out of the house first gets a bonus, a big one. I find I want to win badly. Based on my last few jobs, I feel like I'm getting closer and closer to the top of that ladder. But walking away with that painting would confirm I'm the best he has. After researching the art in question, I was a little disappointed it's not one of the big ones, like that yellow poppy painting by Van Gogh that's still in the wind. The one I'm after is worth about $5 million, and it's not even cute. I was given the details on this job 36 hours ago, and the more I dig into it, the more I'm convinced Mr. Smith wants the painting for himself. So he's made a game of getting it. It wouldn't be the first job where there is no client. The security system of the Tate House is a nightmare and doesn't make any sense at all. It looks more like an obstacle course. No matter how long I'm in this business, I'll never understand rich people. Old Ralph believes his system is impossible to breach, but I've got Devin on my team. There is nothing I've requested from him that he has not delivered, and he can say the same about me. I walk into Buffalo Wild Wings and scan the restaurant for him. He nods when we make eye contact, and I make my way through the crowd to the booth where he's waiting. Sliding in across from him, he passes me a beer. If we were in private, I'd throw my arms around him, pulling him in for a hug, since I haven't seen him in a while. But he insists that in public we do nothing to draw attention to ourselves. But I do get a small smile, and I return it with a much bigger one. "Those colors look good on you," I say. He's wearing a Cowboys jersey, even though I know he hates them. He wore it because he knew more than half of this restaurant would be wearing apparel celebrating the home team. As I glance around the room, all I see is a field of blue, white, and silver.
"Don't start. The things I do for you."
He rolls his eyes and fake gags. "You love me, I know it." I tip my bottle, tapping it against the neck of his. "Cheers."
"Yeah, yeah,"
he mumbles, then takes a swig of his beer.
"First time you've been sent to Texas. Not sure I like it."
Devin's weariness for anything new is the one constant in my life. "Maybe my territory is expanding," I say with a laugh. He tilts his head to the side, his expression telling me he's not so sure. But he doesn't say anything else once the waitress approaches the table. "Hey, hon," she says. "Can I get you something to eat?" I look at Devin and he says,
"I got the burger and fries. It's good. You'll like it."
I nod and say, "Same for me." Once the server has walked away, I pull a manila envelope out of my bag and hand it to him, filling him in on everything I know so far. I sip my beer while he reads what I've given him, relaxing for the first time since I crossed the state line into Texas. I know Devin arrived at least an hour before I did, and did a sweep of the place for any bugs or recording devices, even though absolutely no one knows we'd be here. Our food is delivered, and I people watch while Devin carefully reads each page. A kid stops a few feet away from our table and says,
"This phone sucks. I can't get this pic to download."
He and his friend examine the device and then walk away. I chuckle and Devin looks up at me. I point to the small black device on the table. "How big of a dead zone did you make?" He chuckles as he glances at the kid.
25-foot diameter.
Then his attention is back on the plans in front of him. I gaze around the room, noticing everyone is having similar issues with their devices. Devin is causing chaos around us.
Everyone is freaking out.
I'm saving a lot of people from making bad decisions right now.
His eyes go to the rowdy bar, not too far away, for just a second or two.
They'd thank me later if they could.
Finally, he turns over the last page and looks at me.
I've never seen a security system designed like this.
Can you hack it? Devin cocks his head, giving me a look. A look that says, don't dare insult me like that. Lay it out for me, I say with a smile. He digs through the stack of papers and pulls out a floor plan.
This setup is gorgeous, super hot. There's no reason for how it's laid out, and that makes it exquisite.
He points to one section and asks,
the painting is believed to be in this room in the middle of the house, correct?
Yeah, it's his trophy room, where he keeps those stuffed exotic animals he killed in Africa. I've found a few pictures from inside that room. There's also one of those commercial cigar humidors and a tequila collection that'll make your mouth water. I pull a piece of paper from the pile. And this drawing shows the addition made to the room shortly after that painting went missing. Looks like there was a false wall added that retracts. My best guess is that the painting, and whatever else he's obtained illegally, can be hidden behind that wall if he's got people in the room he doesn't trust to see it. Devin studies the drawing of the addition, then goes back to the main set of blueprints.
You'll need to be at the keypad outside the room, where you believe the painting is kept.
Then he moves his finger across the page, tracing lines that represent cables and wires.
While I'm here at the backup system to prevent it from kicking in right away, neither can be accessed remotely. It's devastatingly simple, but chaotic. And you will only have maybe 5 minutes. 5 minutes inside a room we haven't seen, so there's no telling what else awaits you there. No other way around it. It's magnificent, really.
He doesn't have a special someone, but if he ever gets one, I hope he feels the same way about them that he does for a well-made security system. Why only 5 minutes once I'm inside? If you disarm it, does it not stay disarmed? He shakes his head slowly.
Nope. Mr. Tate has employed a system that records every second of what happens in that room. And there's an alarm that goes off if the feed is interrupted for longer than that amount of time. But I can't override or bypass it because that system is in the room. Can't be accessed remotely either.
He points to two areas and goes into a complicated description of wires that need to be short-circuited and lots of other things that I don't understand.
The timing has to be perfect, absolutely perfect, down to the second. The alarm only rings in the guardhouse, so you won't even know you've tripped it until it's too late.
Devin's eyes continue to roam the plans, while his head shakes slowly back and forth like he can't believe what he's seeing.
As much as I love this, it's not right. I mean, who does this? I don't like this for you. There's something else going on.
I think it's a game. I was already told I wouldn't be the only one trying to get the painting.
But why?
He asks.
Is Smith sending multiple people in, or are there some other players involved?
I think this is all Mr. Smith.
But why?
Devin asks again.
This doesn't make sense.
I shrug. It wouldn't be the first time he did something like this. I think he gets bored and decides to play games. Rich people are weird. Devin's head tilts to the side.
Can you say no to the job?
This gives me pause. You really don't think I should do it?
I don't know.
He's chewing on his bottom lip as he studies the drawings. I lean forward, trying to see it the way he does. I'm not sure I can say no. I've never turned a job down.
I need some more time with this. How soon do you want to try for it?
I shove a few fries in my mouth while I consider my next move. I need to go to Austin for a few days. Tate is having a huge 4th of July party at his house this weekend. Might be the best time to hit him if you can get it all figured out by then. Get everything we need while I'm gone. It's a risk putting it off since I don't know who else or even how many other people are trying to get that painting. But it's a risk worth taking, especially if Devin needs more time on his end. I pause a moment before adding, you're going to have to find a way to get into the party. This isn't a job where you can pull the van up close by and do your thing from there. He nods.
I know.
Devin is comfortable in those dark spaces, behind the scenes, but that won't be possible on this job. I knock my foot against his under the table. You got this.
He drags a fry through a mountain of ranch dressing.
I guess we'll see.
This cover of Sweet Home Alabama would be pretty good if the lead singer wasn't off-key and whiny, because the rest of the band is killing it. I bang my head to the beat regardless. I got to Austin just before they took the stage, and I've been front row for the entire show. The lead singer has noticed. He stared at my chest for the past two songs, so I pull my tight V-neck down a bit more to make it easier for him. Once they finish the set, he catches my eye, then nods toward backstage. Shoving my way through the crowd, I push past the curtain to find him waiting for me. He pulls me in close and kisses me hard, completely foregoing any introductions. I give him a little leeway before I pull away.
"Y'all sounded so hot out there,"
I say, my hands roaming up his chest while his fingers dig into my hair, which has recently been dyed a beautiful shade of cobalt blue.
"I like this color," he says.
"I'm a big fan of Blue Line."
I rub up against him.
"The biggest."
He nods his head toward the back door of the club.
"Want to get out of here?"
His bandmates hear him and yell his name.
"Sawyer, you're not fucking bailing before we get this gear loaded."
He pulls me close, tugging my hand around his waist. I dip my fingers right under the waistband of his jeans, my nails scratching gently into his skin.
"Yeah, let's get out of here," I say.
"Gotta go. I owe you one,"
he yells without ever looking back at them.
"Fuck you, Tate."
I believe he would have been booted from this band long ago if dear old dad, Ralph Tate, wasn't funding this little endeavor, because he's easily the worst member in talent and usefulness.
"What's your name?"
he asks, ignoring everyone behind us. Helen White is not going to cut it. I wrinkle my nose and bite my bottom lip. He stares at my mouth like I knew he would. Then I whisper,
"Kitty."
He makes a cat noise. It takes everything in me not to roll my eyes. Sawyer gives me a grin while he grabs my ass with one hand and pushes open the back door with the other. He's going to be a tough one to wrangle. But if there's one thing I know, it's how to handle trust fund babies with big egos. The Tate 4th of July party is a big shindig, complete with pig chases, lasso roping contests, and a 30-minute fireworks display planned for just after the sun sets. It is one of the hardest invites to get, unless you're his son's band groupie. Sawyer and I, along with 20 of his closest friends, show up an hour late. I've done as much recon on this little group as I can, trying to see if anyone else is using him to get inside the house. But they have been fried since last night, so I think I'm the only plant. It didn't hurt being the girl to show up with the edibles to ensure they stayed that way. We pull up to the valet stand, the other four cars in our caravan behind us. Sawyer throws his keys at the poor, pimple-faced teen manning the station.
"Keep it close. We're not staying long."
I sidle up next to him, my hand slipping around his back, and we walk inside the sprawling house.
"But you promised me fireworks," I say, my lips pouting.
"I got your fireworks, kitty cat," he says while grabbing his crotch.
While this is the easiest way to get into the party, it is also the grossest. As soon as we enter the house, I hear someone shout,
"Sawyer!"
We both turn to find Ralph Tate staring at us from the top of the stairs. I knew I'd be memorable walking in with Sawyer, so I played to it. My jean shorts are short enough that I have a little ass hanging out of the back, and the American flag bikini top leaves little to the imagination. My hair is blue in honor of my country on its birthday and my great love for Sawyer's band, Blue Line. Some well-placed temporary tattoos, smoky eyes, and fire engine red lipstick complete the look. I am hiding in plain sight. Ralph Tate approaches us slowly, and I can feel Sawyer tense up next to me. He wants to cause a scene, wants it to look like he's thumbing his nose at Daddy's money. But I know he'll crumble the second Daddy threatens to take the money away. These boys are so predictable.
"Son, I believe you mentioned a few friends would be joining you."
He eyes the group behind us.
"This is a bit more than we planned for."
Sawyer spreads his arms out wide.
"It's either all of us or none of us."
This fucking tool. I hold my breath, hoping Ralph isn't about to throw us out just to put him in his well-deserved place. Luckily, Mrs. Tate steps in to smooth things over.
Honey, we always have room for you and your friends.
She's not his mother, since she's only about 6 years older than him, but she likes the show as much as Sawyer does. Ralph disappears outside, while the missus points us in the direction of food and booze. I dig my phone out of my back pocket to send Devin a quick text. Tick-tock. Sawyer gets swept up by a group of girls he's known since childhood, while I slip away to the bar, swaying just enough to make it look like I'm as high as the crowd I showed up with.
Vodka cranberry, I say.
Devin is behind the bar. I would not recognize him if I didn't know it was him. He's wearing the same uniform as the other servers, but he's got a pretty groovy mustache going on and dreads in place of his normally short hair. When he told me his revised plan, I was surprised he was willing to interact with so many people, but happy he's getting out of his comfort zone. He stood in the shadows long enough. Devin hands me a drink that I know will contain zero alcohol, then checks his watch.
No changes. Camera's out at 4:17.
Since we knew we wouldn't be the only ones attempting this job, he tapped into the security system within hours of leaving Buffalo Wild Wings, and he's been watching the house ever since. He texted me the number 4 last night, letting me know how many failed attempts to get the painting there have been so far. I don't have the details yet, but since he said no changes, it seems like no one has tried it the way we have planned. How many on deck? I ask.
3, but hopefully they're waiting until the show,
he answers. I nod and slip away. We tossed around waiting until the fireworks started to make our move, like he believes the other 3 people here for the painting will be doing. But we knew we might face a crowd if we wait that long, so we're going for it in broad daylight. I drop down in a chair near the patio door and watch the clock. We have timed this to the second, so as soon as it hits 4:17, I put my drink on the small side table and make my way into the house. Once I've cleared the main area, I walk with purpose to the bathroom located off the back hall. I've memorized the floor plans so there are no wrong turns. I lock the door once I'm inside and pull the bag Devin stowed in the cabinet earlier. There is a black wig and server's uniform, a pair of gloves, a watch, and a big black trash bag. I put everything on over my shorts and bikini top in record time. I shouldn't be caught on any cameras, but Kitty is too memorable if I bump into someone in the hall. Once I'm out of the bathroom, I send Devin a text. Go. Making my way through the house, I get to the back hall where a left will take me to Mr. Tate's trophy room. I turn right. I keep my head low as I pass through the kitchen, holding the trash bag in front of me like a shield. No one spares me a second glance since it looks like I'm on my way to take the garbage out. A few more turns and I'm in front of the door to the laundry room. I send another text. Ready. There's a small keypad outside the door, and the light flashes from red to green. I open the door and step inside, put the trash bag on top of the dryer, then pull out a small black device from inside the bag. I hold it up to the cabinet doors next to the washer, entering the series of numbers that Devin has texted me. You cannot tell there is a lock on this cabinet from the outside, but in a few seconds I hear a click, and the doors pop open. Inside the cabinet is a clothes rod full of hunting clothes. Grabbing a fistful at a time, I remove all the clothes from the cabinet, then hold the black box against the panel that was hidden behind them. Devin sends me another set of codes that I plug into the device. A few seconds later, it pops open, and I'm looking at a very expensive, but also very ugly painting. I take the painting, leaving the replica that was hidden in the trash bag in its place. Luckily, the painting isn't very big. Once the clothes are all back on the rod, Devin helps me work my way out of the system, locking each door in place. Within minutes, I'm back in the hall outside the laundry room and moving toward the garage. My heart races as one of the men hired to patrol the house turns the corner, nearly bumping right into me. He catches himself by grabbing onto my arm.
My apologies. Shouldn't have taken that turn so quickly, he says.
I give him the laugh he's looking for.
No worries, I say.
He waves an almost empty water bottle at me, then dips his head to the trash bag in my hand. I open the bag and he chucks it in.
Thanks,
he says.
No problem,
I reply, and hope the painting can handle a little bit of water. Keeping my head down, I walk out the side door to the garage, where the trash bins are located. I strip out of the uniform, leaving me in my shorts and bikini top, and shove the clothes and wig in the garbage bag with the painting, then tie off the bag before dumping it all in the garbage can. Once I'm in the backyard, I text Evan. I took out the garbage. He will retrieve the bag before cutting the cameras back on. 20 minutes after I set my drink down on that side table, I'm picking it back up. The ice is barely melted. I take a deep drink, then go find Sawyer. He's sitting on the side of the pool, and I squeeze between him and a blonde so I can take her spot next to him. She's not happy.
Where you been, baby?
He slurs. Looking for you? He throws an arm around me, pulling me close, then starts talking to the girl on his other side. I sip on my drink and take a deep breath. I owe Devin big for this job. The day after we met at Buffalo Wild Wings, he showed up in Austin. I found him on the children and teens floor of the Central Public Library, where he was teaching three middle school girls how to play chess on the life-size board. For all his rules and procedures, he's a complete softie when it comes to kids. I slid into one of the many chairs in that area and let them finish. As soon as the girls were lining up the oversized pieces for a new game, he picked up the cardboard tube and motioned for me to join him in one of the private study rooms. Next to the black box that would ensure that no one was listening in on our conversation, we bent over those blueprints a second time.
Are you sure the painting is in that room?
He had asked. I leaned across the table and tried to see what he saw, but nothing jumped out at me. That room is more fortified than any other spot in that house. The false wall addition implies he's hiding something there. You said the system is, what was the word you used? Exquisite? Everything points to the painting being in that room.
But you said you think this is a game, right? You won't be the only one there looking for it.
I nodded, and he pointed to a small corner of the house.
You see this right here?
I moved in close and squinted like that would help me see what he wanted me to see. It didn't. Give it to me like I'm dumb, I finally said. His finger tapped on the space labeled laundry room.
See all the wires running to this room?
I nodded again.
This is overkill for a room that houses at most a washer and dryer.
It didn't take me long to catch on. So you think the trophy room is bait? Send everyone to a room protected with a ridiculous system they can't get past. Once they trip it, which they will, guards get a silent alarm and go scoop them up. Meanwhile, that painting is hidden next to the deep freeze. Devin gave me a huge smile.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
And you're still good to come in with me? Play a part? I asked. He nodded.
Already working on my disguise.
There was actually a hint of excitement in his words I would not have expected. And he was right. By now, Devin has secured the painting and has left the Tate property. I'll hang out as long as Sawyer wants, then ditch him once we leave here. I dig out the small white paper swan that I tucked away in my back pocket this morning and set it in the water. It bobs and weaves its way across the pool. I take another sip of my drink. It won't be long before the fireworks start. I'm expecting the call, but jump anyway when the phone rings. The burner was waiting on my kitchen table the second I got home from the party. Yes?
The blue hair looks better than I thought it would,
Mr. Smith says in his mechanical voice. It's going to be a bitch to remove. He laughs quietly.
The package will be picked up shortly, and details on the next job will be delivered along with confirmation of your deposit, which includes the bonus.
I open my laptop and log into my account, where I can already see that the money has been deposited. I start the process of moving it, just like always. I'll be here. I think he's about to hang up. Then he adds,
I must say, I'm impressed you recovered it.
How many people did I beat? I'm doing a little fishing of my own. I don't think he's going to answer, so I push just a little. Was I the underdog? I want to know how many more rungs of this ladder I need to climb to make it to the top. He lets out a soft chuckle.
You've always had an ego problem, Luca.
I call it confidence, and it's worked well for me so far. I purr into the phone. The silence stretches, but I wait him out. If he wasn't going to tell me, he would have hung up by now. he finally says.
I'm only going to tell you this now, since you were the victor and had the nerve to ask.
When he doesn't say any more for a full minute, I say, you've worked me up and I'm right on the edge. Don't be a tease now. That laugh again.
Let's just say I needed to see who of mine would rise to the top under less than ideal circumstances, and who can recognize when the most obvious path is the wrong one. Congratulations.
Was there even a client? This didn't feel like a real job.
The job is always real, but you may not always be aware of what the end goal is.
Before I can say anything else, Mr. Smith says,
answer the door. I'll be in touch soon.
The call ends and I move to the door. Peeking through the peephole, I see my guy in his usual UPS outfit holding a small box. Right on time, I say as I pull open the door. He hands me the small box and I give him the painting wrapped in brown paper. Want to come in for a drink? We can get drunk and spill all our secrets, I say with a wink. You know you want to, George.
You know I can't do that, no matter how much I want to.
George and I have developed an easy camaraderie over the years. It's hard to make friends in this business, since I'm always on the move. Devin is really the only true friend I have. But sometimes we go months without seeing each other. George is the only other constant in my life. Well, other than Mr. Smith, but I'm not sure he'll ever be more than a mechanical voice to me.
So, blue hair, huh?
He asks. I shake my head around.
You like it?
I like the blonde hair you had in New Orleans. That may be my favorite.
I laugh. Well, I may be blonde again after I strip this color out.
Okay, Luca. Gotta get this to the big guy. Stay out of trouble.
Leaning into the hall when he starts to walk away, I call out, I'm going to wear you down one of these days and talk you into staying for a drink. He stops a few feet away and turns back around to face me.
If anyone could tempt me into breaking the rules, it would be you.
He steps back in closer and adds,
just remember, the bigger the job, the closer you're watched. Eyes are everywhere.
I watch him walk away while I consider his warning. It's not the first time he's given me one. And I hope not the last.